So I got to ask, how did you guys get started? What led you down the path of recording these?
That's a good question. I don't know. I'd kind of wanted to do a podcast, but I'm a lazy ass. And then one day Renee just IM'd me and he's like, "Do you want to do a podcast?" And I said, "Yes, and I have a name."
Very nice.
Yeah.
Can't really hope for it to be easier than that.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, so I bought this, like, I spent like a couple of hundred bucks on a mic because Gruber wanted me to go on the talk show. And I was like, okay, well, I don't want to sound like a total asshole. I've been on a couple of podcasts before and I always sounded like I was recording from my bathroom.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah.
So John just gave me gave me a checklist of shit to buy and I just bought it. And then I think I bitched on Twitter, not bitched, but I'm like, I've got a $200 mic that I never use for anything. And then I think that's when Renee got in touch with me.
I like how that plays out.
Yeah, because I wanted to do a developer show to go with, like, to be a companion show to Iterate for a long time, but I could never found someone crazy enough to do it.
Well, Guy is your guy.
Yeah, I'm dumb that way.
I like to think of you like special forces for developer interviews, Guy.
Thanks.
You know, that actually, the mental image kind of works there. You got like that scrappy Wolverine look. So.
Yeah.
You just deploy them and magic happens.
Yeah, just drop me behind the lines. And
exactly. Yeah. No, I like that. And Renee, I'm kind of curious too. How, because you've been with iMore, you're the managing editor. Like, what got you into podcasts? Is this something you've always wanted to do? Or
no, actually, I basically complained my way into a job at iMore because the old editor left and I was just a reader. And I was like, why are you guys so slow? You guys suck. It's horrible. And I was young at the time and I was used to message boards. And the guy there, Dieter Bohn, who's now at The Verge, is just like, well, why don't you write something? I'm like, fine, I will. So I did. And then he's like, well, why don't you just run the site? I'm like, fine, I will. So I started doing that. And then
I did not know that you got there by complaining to Dieter.
I did. I mean, it was fantastic because Dieter was in his defense, Dieter was running the entire network. Like, he was doing most of the content on Trio Central and on WM Experts back then, the Windows mobile site back then.
Yep.
And it was, and he also didn't like the iPhone much because for him, it wasn't a smartphone until it could run its own apps. And this was like 2007. Mm-hmm. So he didn't really want to do it. So they had me start doing it. And the other guy who I replaced stayed on doing podcasts for a while, but he said he's not going to do it for long. So I started doing it and all my friends said, you suck at this so incredibly badly. You should stop now because you are that guy on American Idol whose family has told him you can sing. And then the judges get a hold of you. And I'm screw you. I'm going to get this right. So I just kept practicing.
They say practice makes perfect. I'd say you nailed it. Have you gotten your 10,000 hours in? That's the real question.
I think I'm
a bit close.
Yeah, I think I'm close to 1,000 episodes of some of different shows.
Yeah, I was going to say, you got to be way up there by now. So, and I also just want to point out that both of you seem to have come together because you bitched. So you make the perfect pair.
Pretty much. Yeah.
It's one of those point. Shows, like when Guy's on a podcast and he ends up interviewing the host, I can tell that already.
I was just thinking that, yeah, Ryan's turning the tables on us already.
No, just breaking the ice. I mean, Guy, I know you through WWDC and Singleton stuff, but yeah. Renee, I don't think we've ever met, so.
We've passed. We've been in the same room together. I've been assured several times, but I've never had the good fortune of meeting you yet.
Oh, well, you've both been at Singleton, so.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, so that's a very, we probably have run into each other then at some point.
But Singleton, I mean, it's not the biggest room in the world, but there's still so many people and so many interesting people that you can spend an entire day just in one corner.
No, I totally agree. And honestly, Guy, I got to say that is the single problem with Singleton, and I didn't mean for that to rhyme. You get too many interesting people there. I get stuck in a corner. People start walking by. I'm like, oh shit, I got to catch up with Jury. And oh hey, there's Craig. And oh well, crap, there's Gruber. I got to deal with him. You end up. It feels like you meet a ton of people, but in reality, it's more of just like mingling with the people that you already know. And by extension, of course, you meet some fantastic other people. Uh-huh. It's just a very different vibe and a good vibe. Like, I'm totally joking when I say it's a problem.
No, I understand. We do kind of want to encourage people to mix it up. I don't know how to do that without being weirdly artificial.
Folk dancing.
No, and I don't think you really need to try that hard to get people to mix it up. I think it's, again, just by having the conversations with people and networking naturally. Mm-hmm. You just mingle and have fantastic conversations. If you try to enforce it, it would become, that square dancing mentality of
right. Yeah, like I'm going to assign tables to people.
I got a do-si-do with you now.
Yeah, I was going to say grab Gruber do-si-do, spin around.
There's a mental image.
But yeah, no, I mean, pretty much everybody there is interesting.
Yeah, no, and you've really narrowed that down to a very excellent, well, self-selecting population, I guess, because you haven't handpicked anyone aside from the speakers, of course. But it's come together as a very nice conference.
Should be fun. We're just in the final stages of wrapping up the this next one.
Oh man, I can't wait. I'm really excited for this next one. It's actually, you know, I don't know how this works out, but I always manage to schedule or have something scheduled immediately after Singleton. So I think last year it was my mother's birthday. I'm not going to say which one, but it was a big one. Mm-hmm. And my family got together in Chicago. We just randomly decided, well, not randomly. My parents used to live in Chicago for a while, but we decided to go there. And it was scheduled for months in advance as the weekend or the week after Singleton, or at least when Singleton got planned. Mm-hmm. So I had to jump out that Sunday and miss kind of the wrap up stuff. And then this year I have a friend's wedding the week after Singleton.
Really?
And of course it's in Shanghai. So I've got to leave Sunday to get there in time for Monday afternoon for the wedding on Tuesday. So
wow, that's crazy. Like at least Chicago's kind of on your way home to San Francisco.
Oh yeah, it worked out perfectly. It was like a hop back home.
Yeah.
Shanghai's a little out of the way.
You think so? A little bit.
Just a touch. Wow. But it's totally worth it. I love making that conference. It's become one of the highlights of my year, honestly, without like any trying to suck up or anything like that. It really is just an absolute blast.
Oh, thanks, man. I really appreciate that. I've not attended. I mean, I keep making that joke all the time, but I mean, I'm always in a haze when it's going on.
I can't even imagine. Like the number of things that your team just deals with is incredible. And it's executed perfectly. There's rarely any issues that crop up. And with the number of people that you pull in, just hell, dealing with the catering alone sounds like I need a gun. Like I couldn't put up with that. You handle it with aplomb and everyone you work with handles it quite well. So.
Yeah. Well, we've been very fortunate. There's, Luke and Scott do a lot of great work and, the guests are awesome. Nobody really complains about anything. Like the Wi-Fi is often just spotty because, it's hotel Wi-Fi.
Well, it's hotel Wi-Fi. Well,
it's also old Montreal, 300-year-old buildings.
Yeah, 300-year-old building with like 6-foot thick brick walls.
Yeah, lead-lined brick walls.
It's meant to stop pretty an American much. Invasion.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much. And people are just understanding. And you, as much as you tell the hotel, like, no, really, there's going to be a lot of people trying to connect to the Wi-Fi, like a lot of devices. They don't understand that, everyone in this room has like three devices,
Yeah, exactly. You think the hotel's mental image is, this is going to be just another group of people coming in. Yeah. No, guys, sorry. Some people are going to have two laptops. There's going to be iPads and iPhones. Some people might have multiple phones.
So, yeah, a couple of people. I mean, that's a sore spot. There's not much we can do to fix it. I mean, every year they tell us it's getting better. And it has been getting better. They've actually been improving it. But I don't think it'll ever get fixed. And sort of a dirty secret is that I'd rather have people listening to the talks than dicking around on their laptops. So, yeah, it's a problem. But I'm not terribly motivated to fix it that much. You know what I mean?
No, it's a great problem to have. I mean,
yeah. Sounds like a bit of a dick move, but whatever.
No. I think it's a very tactical move. It's well executed. Hotel Wi-Fi is only a problem when you need to get shit done.
Yeah.
And hopefully at Singleton, people aren't trying to get shit done. They're trying to actually participate and be a part of the conference. I mean, that should be the shit they're getting done.
Yeah. I think if you're trying to get shit done, I mean, whatever, go to your room and do it.
Yeah, seriously. No harm, no foul. I mean, you got to do what you gotta do, but.
Yeah.
It's all those Americans on the table with their MLB app trying to get the game going while we're guys putting on a show.
Hey, now let's be honest. Some of us are streaming college football games too. So don't be totally
I do want to ask Ryan, how do I pronounce your last name so I don't make a dick out of myself at the beginning of this?
Nielsen, just like the rating system.
All right, perfect.
Yep. I kind of wish I had one of those fancy. I can't even think of a fake pronunciation for my name. It's
the simple ones that fool you. I'll be like, no, it's Nielsen, and I'm like, oh damn, I'm sorry.
You know what has screwed me up for years? And guy, I'm going to pick on you again, but it's your name, damn name.
Really?
For ages, I was afraid, like deathly afraid, that I'd walk up to you one day and be like, hey, Guy, how are you? Or call you Guy and your name is actually Guy. And then I'm the American asshole who's like, hey, Guy, what up?
I don't mind. You know what? That used to annoy me when I was a teenager. people got it wrong or called me Gee, and I don't care. It's perfectly understandable if you think my name is Gee. Gee English is a bit weird, though.
That, yes.
Like, although I've got to say, Guy English is just also stupid. But, you know, I'm stuck with it. I remember meeting – do you remember when I met you the first time?
Oh, God, my memory's horrible. And it was probably at a WWDC event.
Yeah, Chieftain after it was, WWDC.
Oh, yes. I do remember that, actually. Vaguely. Yes.
Well, I mean, yeah, we'd been drinking. And you were at Apple at the time.
Yep.
You were a product manager when I was 10.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
And you told me that, and I didn't believe you. I literally said, fuck you. You're not a product manager. No, I can't. And I don't know why I didn't believe you. I don't know.
Was this an introduction done by Dave Wiskus?
Oh, could have been.
So for a long time, and he still may do it now for all I know, Dave would introduce me as the guy who wrote OS X. And it was a great icebreaker. I mean, he walks up to somebody, he's like, oh, hey, do you know Ryan? You got to know Ryan. He wrote OS X. I just kind of stand there dumbfounded, like, how do I recover from that? Like, do I tell him the truth, which is I'm a project manager on OS X, which effectively, like, I oversaw a lot of the things that went on, but created? No, God, no. Like, to claim that would insult thousands of people, viciously insult thousands of people. But then to say something else would be, well, kind of a letdown. Like, oh, well, you kind of suck. Why am I talking for you?
Right. Maybe that's it. Maybe Whiskers set the stage in a weird way that I'm like, nah, fuck you. This guy did not write OS X. Like, I would know. But I didn't believe you to the point where you're a very friendly, gregarious guy. And I was just like, nah, fuck you. You didn't do that. And you were like, no, really, I am. And I thought you were pulling my leg to the point where you gave me your email address at Apple. And I sent to that email address an email with just the subject, fuck you.
I do remember that.
Just to test it. And that, in retrospect, was the stupidest thing I could have done. Because you could have just given me somebody's like important email address, and I would have just said fuck you to them, like, randomly out of the blue.
To be honest, like, the email addresses that I could have given you that would have been important, like B. Sirlay or S. Jobs.
Yeah, I probably would have guessed.
Yeah, you would have picked up on that and been like, oh, yeah, he is an asshole.
Yeah, but some weird mid-level manager I wouldn't have heard of just randomly getting spammed by me is probably not a good thing.
I really should have done that. That would have been awesome.
I'm glad you didn't. Anyway, so, you know, we hit it off right off the bat.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was a match made in Chieftain.
So how'd you get into this, man? What do you...
Well, that's the existential question. By this, do you mean...
The tech game. Let's go back to, you know...
Go back to the good old days. As cheesy as it sounds, I'm one of those people who's always been into computers. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said earlier, my memory is really just horrible. But the memories that I do have of growing up, you know, there's like the Saturday morning cartoons with Bugs Bunny and Looney Tunes and stuff like that. I remember like playing around in my neighborhood in Denver, Colorado, and, you know, playing in the blizzards or running around with friends during the summer. And then I also distinctly remember like actually sitting in front of the Apple IIe that my father brought home one day, and just dicking around with it, you know, doing obviously the game stuff. You know, I had educational games and the requisite Oregon Trail and shit like that. So good. It wasn't until the Mac version though that really took off, I think, at least for me. Mm. But what it comes down to is that I remember getting like it was a weekly or a monthly magazine, and I think it was related to a PBS show called 321 Contact. It was like an educational show, stylized for kids. It was really well done, actually, if I remember correctly. And the magazine was in the spirit of the show. Like, they had mathematical puzzles and brain teasers and stories about scientific things, all done in a very gamey, stylized manner. But in the back of the magazine, like on the final pages, would be a basic game that you would then enter into the Apple II or whatever basic compiler interpreter you had, mm-hmm. and play the game, whatever tiny little game it happened to be. And, you know, my rosy memory is I would type these in and nothing would obviously work at all ever, because right. I was like 6'5" at the time. Like, it would not work. Yeah. And then my dad would come along and help me figure out, basically rewrite the thing and yeah. get it working. In reality, it was probably my father typing it himself the first time, it not working, coming along and rewriting it and getting it working again.
That's exactly how I got into stuff. My first one, every time I had a syntax, like, I typed it all in when I had a syntax error. You know, you could just type the line number to delete the line.
Yep.
That's what I would do. I would just delete lines that had syntax errors in them. Didn't work too well.
Yeah, you get something. It's a basic program. Whether or not it's a working correct basic program is unlikely. But I remember being amazed that, and I guess this is why the memory sticks with me, that I could take something that was in the back of a magazine and somehow get it into this machine, this glowing box in front of me, and stuff happens. And I think that was kind of like the seeds that got planted. And ever since then, like, growing up, I played HyperCard when we got our first Mac. Our high school had like a basic, really basic computer skills class. Or sorry, my middle school had a really basic computer skills class. But the teacher, just for the more advanced students, let us really kind of do whatever the hell we wanted. And there we'd make HyperCard games. We'd play with the ClarisWorks database and just kind of explore off on our own and figure out different things. And then this was about the time that I think AOL came along, signed up for an AOL account, never really migrated away from that until high school, but just gradually accruing all of this interest in computers and technology. And somehow I ended up getting subscribed to, or the family got subscribed to Macworld. And, you know, that's a whole other different addiction of reading those every time they came in. And then Wired hits the scene and you feel like you're this edgy tech guy with all these fancy covers. And of course, during all of this, I'm surrounded by my fellow nerdy friends and we're arguing about whatever random stuff. If it's not Star Trek related, it was probably something like Macs versus PCs. And just kind of had that ethos. And then in high school, I took my first programming course and it was natural. I didn't have any problems with the AP computer science curriculum that was being offered. It just flowed. So again, it was kind of one of those cases where the teacher was like, okay, this group, you know what you're doing. Just don't cause problems. Leave me alone. I'll deal with all the other people who actually need the assistance and need the instruction. So you do self-exploratory, like write a game engine or figure out. And of course my game engine was like balls bouncing around a room. It was lame, but just kind of figuring things out like that. And then, of course, in college, computer science degree and yada, 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 I end up here where I am. So, yeah, I guess that's kind of the short narrative story, is just always being immersed in that computing environment. And for some reason, having that knack, that addiction, I guess, of wanting to learn more, wanting to read articles about CPU architecture and dive in deep on operating system design and just dabble all over the place.
Do you have a specific, like a particular interest in any one area?
It would be operating systems. Very much so. God, I love operating systems. So in college, that was a computer science degree in college. Obviously I went to the University of Colorado. And I don't know why I said that was obvious, because it shouldn't be to anyone, but I got the computer science degree at University of Colorado, and CU, I hope still is. It's been a while since I've actually met with anyone who's been involved with the program. But at the time when I was going through it, was very heavily focused on everything Unix related. Like, there were very C-based curriculum, very Unix-focused curriculum. Windows was just derided and laughed out the door. Java was only barely starting to make inroads in some of the classes. And it was honestly never none of the introductory classes. It was only in some of the later, like, I want to say one of the professors who taught compiler design began using Java for his class. And thankfully I missed that class. I took the compiler design course from the instructor who was teaching it with C, or C++. I think it was a C++ based course. So I was always, again, kind of steeped in this operating system Unix-y environment. And if I remember correctly, there, large chunks of OpenBSD were written by somebody at CU at the time as well. And then Sun had a major focus. Sun Computers had a huge focus there. There was a big Sun campus, and I do mean was a big Sun campus, near Boulder, Colorado.
Was Solaris open at the time? No, it seems like that's a little early for that. Yeah.
So yeah, Solaris opened up. The Open Solaris Project began, if I remember correctly, my senior year of college, so 2004.
Yeah, okay.
That sounds about right. But we had all variety of Sun boxes on campus. Everything from SunOS 2 or 3 systems that had been sitting around in some professor's, you know, he had his computer. It was exactly the way he wanted it. And be damned if you're ever going to touch it and get him to move up to something that's, you know, made in the past decade. All the way up to huge government-funded mainframe installations doing crazy research for the Navy. So it's just always kind of in this Unix-y operating system-y environment. And really fell in love with it. I've always just been partial to operating systems. I actually subscribed to SIGOS, the special interest group in operating systems. I subscribed to that for probably 3 or 4 years. Like 2 years into me working at Apple, I'd still get the periodic publications and flip through and, you know, read about exokernels and whatever latest permissions-based system was being designed, like Eros and things along those lines.
Oh, yeah. Eros is totally interesting.
Excuse me. It's fascinating stuff. It's honestly, it's the groundwork for some of the things that we see in OS 10 today, OS 10 and iOS today.
About to segue to that. some of the sandboxing stuff is kind of like retrofitting a bit of that. What do they call it? Not compartmentalized.
Again,
because there's very specific words for these concepts, right? But you know what I mean. It's like everything's permission based, right? Like
yes,
you can't do anything without having a specific
capabilities.
Yeah, which is fascinating. Which I think also you kind of need a microkernel, or at least like a message passing.
You need a message passing, or at least for the Eros design, you needed a message passing microkernel. Yeah.
I guess it doesn't have to be a microkernel, but whatever.
It doesn't, but it helped with the validation and authentication system that they had. I'm really reaching deep for some of these memories here, but
it was very central.
There might have been a variant of Eros that used an exokernel-based system where most of the – and Eros itself might have been exokernel-based, where most of the kernel services were not in
space.
Yeah, they were up in user space. I think that might have been central to its design. Yeah. Which led to some of its horrible performance, but it's a fascinating architecture.
I mean, Mach originally was kind of like that, right? Like there was provisions in Mach 2.0, I believe, where the swap could be in user space. Like if it faulted, it would send a message to a user space.
Oh, yeah. I think absolutely. Wasn't
because at one point you could fault over the network.
Oh, wow.
Just for the audience, page with faults, we're talking about like when you try to access a page in memory and you need to swap it in.
Oh, yeah, totally. Who the hell would ever fault over a network? Like, swapping's bad enough. Let's add some millisecond latency to that.
I don't know. It's cool, though.
No, it's fascinating. It's one of those things that I loved about Next. And unfortunately, I never really had a strong introduction to Next. I might have seen one Next box at CU. Doesn't really ring a bell, though. I don't recall seeing that many, if any, at all. So,
but it's pretty familiar. It's a BSD.
Oh yeah, it's a great
Sun sort of, you know, close enough.
Yeah, and I guess that's really how I. So the combination, I guess, of those two interests, operating systems and computers, and really Apple is a particular focus. I've always been an Apple fanboy.
Were you a Mac guy at home? Like, you'd use Unix at school and a Mac at home?
So, like I said, started off with the 2E, and then my father brought home a Mac. Oh man, this would be like third, fourth, fifth grade, something back in that era. Mm-hmm. And used that all the way through until we got a PowerPC. We got one of the PowerPC, one of the clones, Power Computing clones. It was a Power Computing PowerBox something. I don't remember the number. Mm-hmm. So we had that until my father accidentally knocked it off the back of the desk. And basically ruined the graphics card. Like the VGA cable jammed to the graphics card, and it was done at that point. And rather than spend the money to fix it, he just went out and got a gateway PC. And that was my first real introduction to seriously using Windows. Like, I'd used Windows before at friends' houses and things like that, but never literally used Windows.
Yeah. And so 95 at this point, right? At least. Yeah.
That would have been 98, I think.
Okay.
I think it was actually the year 98 when we got it.
Okay.
And I used Windows for a couple of years. I ended up taking that Dell PC to see you with me.
Okay.
And of course, once I get to college, being the nerdy computer science major, well, fuck this Windows shit. Fuck,
of course.
I'm installing Linux, man. This is the way we're going to go. And I kind of dabbled with Linux a little bit in high school. I remember nuking. Okay, so I started with Caldera Linux because it had a really nice GUI installer. Mm-hmm. Politely segregated Windows away, didn't ruin any data or anything like that. And, you know, you start using it for a while and you're talking with people on the internet. And like, oh, you use Caldera? Man, what kind of lame loser are you? Oh, well, fine. I'll try Slackware. How about that? I'll go.
The pissing contest around Linux.
Oh, God, it's so bad.
Yeah.
So I tried installing Slackware on my parents' PC. And, of course, I utterly obliterate the disk. Like, it was miserable. I think I'd upgraded the Windows side of the PC. In fact, I had upgraded the Windows side of the PC to Windows 2000.
Good call.
And oh God, so much better than Windows 98. Actually, that's probably my favorite Windows ever. It was good.
Yep.
And
I think that's
total segue here. Total tangent here. The Windows NT kernel is awesome. Very well designed, incredibly well designed, very nicely architected system. I just wish they would get rid of all the crap on top of it and ship that.
Yep, I agree. In fact, I was kind of bummed out when they moved the graphics drivers into the kernel.
Oh yeah,
it was great. Makes sense performance-wise, but yeah, like NT4, they were outside the kernel.
Yep,
I think they moved them in 2000 or something. But in general, it's a fascinating system. Yeah,
and actually, continuing on this tangent, hasn't Windows 8 re-architected the drivers, the graphics drivers specifically, once again, so that the majority of the drivers actually up in user space?
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know.
I think that might be the case. And that's one of the reasons why Microsoft relented and actually is enabling WebGL and IE11 is because they can do so safely and securely on, at least on Windows 8. I'd have to do research about this because I haven't actually.
That's interesting. And that's fascinating. And WebGL keeps coming up on this show because I'm a GL guy, and exposing that like with the graphics driver stack to the web just seems like a terrible idea.
That's because it is. I mean, it's really a bad idea.
Yeah. But I mean, until you put the driver in user space.
Exactly. I mean, there's ways to do it correctly. And to my knowledge, the only system that might be doing it correctly is Windows 8.
And that's great. Again, I'll have to look at that. Yeah.
Could be totally pulling that fake fact out of my ass, but I'll go with that.
Hey, they finally put the NT kernel on the phone, so at least they have that unified now.
No, that's true. That's actually a very good point, and it's a bad time.
Yeah.
So I guess reeling back from this tangent, I had upgraded my parents' PC to 2000, Windows 2000, and was installing Slackware alongside of it. And I think I was trying to overwrite the Caldera partition, you know, just nuke and pave, start from scratch. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is on the command line. And of course, I'm a total noob at dealing with any of these things at this time. And I probably missed like the slice designation on the disk partition command or something like that.
Oh, man, I hate that.
And just ruined the disk. And, you know, I go downstairs. I'm like, hey, Dad, do you have backups? I mean, please tell me you've got backups, right? And he's like, Brian, what did you do? Like, oh, nothing. I just, you know, figured I'd check and make sure you've got some backups. I take that as a no. You should really consider backing up, Dad. It's a good idea.
Okay.
And then I slinked back upstairs, you know, trying not to pull any more attention to myself. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, oh, shit, how the hell am I going to fix this? I've really screwed it now. And for whatever reason, it occurred to me, like, they're just bits on a disk. I could probably do something with those bits. Mm-hmm. So I went and I finished installing Slackware on the slice that it actually needed to be installed on. I got an external hard drive and installed it on that and booted off that and started triaging the internal hard drive. And I had a hex editor and a PDF of the file system, the NT file system architecture, and the on-disk layout. And I just started grubbing through all of that. And
which is also pretty well done, by the way.
Oh, fantastic. NTFS, I could totally rave about NTFS. And great stuff. And it's great stuff because it has redundant main partition blocks stored in two different locations on the disk. So it can, or two or three different locations. I forget what it was. There's one in the middle of the disk. I think that was the redundant one. And there's one at the front of the disk, of course, that's used by BIOS to boot up the system. And I want to say that there's a third one at the end of the partition, but I could be wrong on that.
I do. Yeah, they are in multiple places to make the seek time faster.
Exactly. And to provide recovery redundancy. Yeah. It's just a nice side effect. So basically, I was reading through this design paper. I'm like, oh, sweet. These glorious designers have actually thought that somebody would do something stupid like this, and went through and basically with a hex editor patched up the file system on my parents' PC, and thank God got everything back up and running. But that was just kind of like another introduction that like I can control and be in command of what's in front of me. Like they're just bits. However I manipulate those bits, I have full control and power over. So, and that was also my first introduction to like being a Linux geek, and the Linux thing lasted all the way through college. Those were the dark years, the years of like recompiling kernels with the specific optimization flags. And I was a big Gentoo Linux fan because it had a really nice system for building your entire OS from scratch. And somehow I thought that was a good idea.
Yeah. I never really got into that. I was.
You're so lucky.
Well, I was a FreeBSD guy.
Well, okay. So you had a make world and FreeBSD. I mean, that was your variant.
I didn't like dicking with it, like changing the kernel under anything. Like BSD had a, I don't know if I'm a better man, but like Linux has that culture of just dicking with stuff.
God, it's so bad.
Also, isn't Gentoo so philosophical? The people I know that use it want it because it's not patent encumbered.
Exactly. Well, it's the same variant of, or it's in the same spirit, I should say, as like Debian, where it's a free and open system and no patent and closed source code is wrapped up in it and yada, yada, whatever. I wasted so much time on that stuff, and I loved it at the time, and I still look back on it fondly because that was those experiences of breaking stuff and building it back up and
that's great.
Trying build flags and seeing things fail and trying different. Oh, I'll use this variant of X Windows, or hey, look, there's this experimental audio system. I'll put that in there and see how that works. It wasted time, sure, but throughout the entire process, it really solidified my mental model of how all that stuff fits together.
Yeah. I think that's actually the real value of it, right? It's like
far and away.
Not that there's like seven different audio systems. It's that by playing with them and realizing how they break, you actually learn how computers work.
That was very much the case for me. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I guess kind of winding the tangent all the way back, that's what led me to the love of Apple operating systems and the computer science background is what led me to Apple. Of course, I applied to like dozens of different jobs at the time because it was not exactly a great time to be hired. This was back in 2004. So the dot-com bust was just starting to recover. I applied everywhere. Like I applied to Microsoft, HP, Sun. I applied to defense contractors. This is not popular today, but I applied to like the NSA and the Defense Intelligence Agency, and I applied everywhere. Like I just anyone who would take my resume, I went for.
Well, not popular today. I mean, I think everybody realizes that very, very smart people work there.
Oh yeah, which is
what,
why they did.
What the smart people are told to do is, you know, maybe that's debatable. But
I don't think it's that debatable. I'm pretty sure it's wrong.
Trying not to get into the politics.
Yeah, we'll step around that gingerly. But I managed to get a phone call from Apple, and actually no, I remember exactly what happened. I was surfing jobs at apple.com like on a daily basis just to see anything that popped up and to try to be the first one on whatever recruiter's email list I could get on.
Did you know anybody there?
I kind of. So I was a campus rep, an Apple campus rep back at CU. So I knew some of the what do they call them? The field installation, I forget the specific, but the people who actually deployed to the campuses and work with people doing installations in field and diagnosing problems and things like that.
Yeah.
I knew a couple of them, but I didn't know anyone directly tied into engineering.
Yeah.
At least not that I recall. Maybe I didn't. I'm just being a jerk right now. So I applied for this job, and I saw this job come up, and it was for program management in the Mac OS X program office, because it was called Mac OS X back in the day. Mm-hmm. And the job description just, it sounded like the perfect blend of all of my skills, where I had to have a technical background, had to have a very strong understanding of operating systems. I had to know how everything fit together, and at least according to the job description, I had to know how everything fit together. I had to be able to present clearly and concisely to everyone ranging from engineers, newly hired interns, all the way up to senior staff. And I had to be able to pick apart and test daily builds and all these things that just like, hey, yeah, check, check, check. Yeah, totally. This is a dream job. And of course, there's the requirement of having like 3 years of experience or whatever boilerplate at the end.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, you know what? I'm just going to toss my resume in that hat and see what happens. And I applied for the job on jobs.apple.com. And
I mean, how many people have 3 years of managing an operating system?
And aren't already doing it.
Yeah. As somebody
kind of a silly requirement.
I can tell you it's a very small group of people.
Right. Yeah.
So I tossed my job in the hat on jobs.apple.com. And thankfully, this was also one of the recruiters who put her email address in the job posting itself, which was rare to begin with and is now completely forbidden, as I understand it.
Hmm.
So I emailed her out of the blue and was just like, hey, saw the job posting on jobs.apple.com, and I think I would be a perfect fit for you. And of course, I sent in my LaTeX formatted PDF resume. Oh, such a nerd back then. sent in my resume, and I was like, I got all these credentials. I had my beautiful cover letter and tossed her the whole packet, and was like, okay, well, that's that. Time to move on. Go do something else. And I was home for Christmas or Thanksgiving, one of the fall holidays, and got an email from the recruiter. And she basically said, hey, so sorry it took me so long to get back to you. We've talked it over, and actually we'd like to give you an interview. Are you available to interview tomorrow? I'm like, hell yeah, I am. But name the time, name the place. I'll do whatever for you guys. Took the phone call, the phone screen, and I remember just being utterly grilled by the phone screen. The engineer who, the project manager at the time, the manager now who interviewed me, is an incredibly talented individual. Like, I have the utmost respect for him, and he just ripped me to shreds. It was glorious. Pulling me down, like, this is back when I was able to describe I had an intimate understanding of machine architecture and operating systems and how everything fit together. So he basically said, like, from the time you power on a system until you get to the finder, or in my case, I went ahead and flubbed it a little bit, was like, you get to the CDE windowing manager. tell me everything that happens. And,
wow, yeah.
And I'm sure in retrospect, he told me that he was expecting, like, oh yeah, you power it on and then the kernel gets loaded and then programs get executed and then you're at the windowing manager.
Yeah, very high level.
Like, yeah. And yeah.
And you're like, well, it reads this sector of the boot disk. And
well, it was like when the mechanical switch clicks in the power button, the CPU gets a, like, I went through all the every step. It was glorious. I loved it. I couldn't do it to save my life now. I could fake it, but I managed to go through that incredible level of detail from the kernel handling stuff, event drivers, all the way up. It was awesome. And he said that was the thing that sealed the deal for him, was I could go into that level of detail and I knew how all the stuff fit together. So when shit breaks in OS X, I could be one of those people who could piece it back together and figure out where it broke and how stuff went wrong. So that got me the on-campus interview. And then the on-campus interview was just a blur. I interviewed with like 12 or 15 different people. It was nuts. But managed to secure that as well. It worked out quite nicely. And then that got me into Apple. It was like the dream job. It was perfect. I was at Apple, where I'd always wanted to be. I was dealing with operating systems, which I loved. And I was working on a team that was able to really, in the Mac OS X program office, we had oversight over just about everything that went on in the operating system world, at least up until like the iPhone split off and they had the very strict secret segregation between, you know, the ultra secret phone project and the rest of the operating system, pretty much everything that went on, we had some visibility into. And, you know, I got to present to, I held meetings all the time with Bertrand, presented to VPs on a regular basis. Like, it was just, it was an incredible opportunity. So much fun, really damn stressful at times. And
yeah, I bet.
Really, really fun. Yeah. So,
so, okay. What are the responsibilities just for the, I mean, I'm aware of them, but let's get into what the job actually entails.
Make sure the system gets shipped. That's, that's the high order goal is I guess to start from scratch, that the primary goal of the program office is to be responsible for each and everything that goes on with that particular program. And in our case, it was OS X. So there'd be a program for OS X. There's a program office for for iOS. And some of the apps teams have kind of their own, like there's at least back when I was at Apple, this could be entirely different now. There is like an apps management program office.
Yeah, the pro apps have one and the other.
Exactly. So that's kind of their overarching goal. And that was whatever it takes to get the system out the door is what you would do. So it'd be like the daily process that it would go through is come in the morning and well, actually typically be like wake up and kick off a remote install of the nightly build of OS X. So that way, when I came in the morning, I could see it sitting at hung at a gray screen or not booting, you know, spewing something in the console. I could see whatever evil was destined for that day and, come in and begin triaging that. Like, okay, we got up to the gray Apple boot screen. Well, shit, that means like Windows Server's not coming up or blah, you know, whatever's going wrong. Yeah. Boot verbosely, attach remotely.
Yeah, I was
going
to say, do you guys boot verbosely by default?
We try not to.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not what the customer does. Yeah. Whenever possible, do what the customer does. That said, I typically had one system that was always like in full debug armor. It booted verbosely. It spewed shit out over serial ports. It was my go-to system for if something wasn't working. I'm just going to get as much information quickly as I can and go from there. Yeah. But like on my laptop, it was always try to do exactly what the customer would do. Like don't deviate from the norm unless there is a legitimate customer driven reason for deviating from the norm. Typically in the morning it'd be figuring out what's wrong with the system and reassembling it back together, trying to get to a working state that's at least good enough to ship that out to all of engineering. And
so figure out who you're going to yell at for the day.
In a way, yes.
I'm being a jerk, but yeah.
Who we're going to work with to get the build working today. And then it's a matter of kind of running down the checklist of what needs to happen next in the system. Like, are we at the point where, and I should probably not go into too much detail about this, but are we at the point where we're figuring out what's going to happen in this release, where we're still gathering ideas and distilling out the nature of the release? Or are we at the point where we're actually implementing and moving forward on these features and these plans? And if we are, then what, you know, what's blocking what and, are there projects that we can or features that we can move forward while these things are having issues over here and how can we work around these problems and having meetings with engineering and cross-functional discussions about where things stand and making sure everyone's on the same page. And it's a lot of cross-coordination really throughout all of engineering. That is our central role. Like if anything, I would say the program office is, you know, some people use the hub and spoke model for this, but that's too organized of a mental image. It's we're the glue that happens to hold together this collection of things and you know, an amorphous blob of all the different talent and all the different skill that is at the company. We're just there to make sure that is as tightly and cohesively held together as possible in whatever way we can, like whether that's improving daily communication emails out to the engineering team, whether that's improving reporting up to senior staff, whether that's getting together two engineers in a room just to sit down and figure out a problem. And, you know, they might not know each other, but we happen to know that they have these issues and putting them together could fix that very quickly. Whatever it takes to try to get things moving forward. And I kind of hinted at this as a result of all that, we're doing constant reporting up to all different parts of the company. And really providing the clearest, most realistic possible picture about where we stand in the release and how well things are going and whether or not we're screwed, basically. And if we are screwed, then we're providing the clearest possible path to unfuck ourselves effectively.
Yeah.
So if you have to have that machine ready for demo at a keynote, it's got to be ready for demo at a keynote.
Oh, holy hell. Yeah. The keynote demos are just terrifying things. It's a rush. It's an incredible rush to see that up on stage and see Bertrand or Craig or Steve back when he was around, Phil demoing things that you've helped put together, but utterly terrifying. You know, all of the tape and all of the spit that's holding that together.
Yeah.
You know that things are hanging on by a thread. And if one mispacket happens, or if there's a slight delay in the subsystem, then everything just goes to hell. And thankfully it rarely happens, but it happens. And yeah, I guess that's another aspect of it is of the job, at least, was preparing for and being largely responsible for a lot of the content that gets presented, or at least the structure of the content, not the actual things. We don't produce slides or anything like that. That's up to Marcom and other teams, the designers there. But kind of the structure and the story, we provide the basic fuel for that. And then that would go off to marketing and Steve or Tim, I guess, these days, and Johnny. And they then turn that into the story that is presented to the public. But it's up to us to kind of figure out, like, these are the things that work. These are the things that are good. We're going to cut these things. And and here is the realistic state of where we're at. And go with it. Have fun. Make an amazing presentation and floor us all with the thematics that are gonna happen.
Yeah. So, I mean, the operating system is in constant development with a bunch of features, and the individual releases are sort of decided upon based on where you stand in the development, and stuff can get pushed to like later releases, right?
Without going into a lot of detail.
Yeah, I don't want to press on something that's maybe you don't want to talk about.
Without going into a lot of detail, yes and no. There's some teams that behave that way, and there are some teams that don't. For a large part, there is an overall set of themes or goals for a release that really kind of can't be removed.
Mm-hmm.
So for Snow Leopard, for example, it would be the performance and refining the system, and then some of the GCD and OpenCL stuff. So it's largely a performance and quality polish focus release with the one new feature of Exchange. Those things were effectively immutable. Now they could change on a minute basis where, okay, some team's adoption of GCD just isn't going well because they have all of their other features that they're dealing with, or they've been pulled over onto this other project and they simply just can't get to this work. And we're like, okay, makes sense. You're going to do it for the next release, or, you know, whatever the prioritization happens to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, across engineering, like, those themes have to be hewed too. But that's not always the case. Like, there are things that are able to be deferred and pushed off. So it's a very organic process. Like, the one thing to take away from all of this is there is no recipe. There is no strict process that can be followed. And anyone who thinks that they can put a strict process around this is really just deceiving themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So much of what I did in the program office as a project manager was, think on my feet, like, okay, crap, this isn't happening. What are our options? Okay,
yeah, you have to face reality, right?
Yeah, exactly. And reality dictates that you're going to bend and break rules, and you're going to negotiate, and you're going to barter and make trade-offs, and you're going to try just to distill things down so that you have the best subset of what you imagined possible as a reality.
Mm-hmm.
And then ship that best possible subset and then move on to the next release and get things going there.
Yeah. Do you think Microsoft does the same thing? To me, it seems like they have a feature list which they consider immutable, and they won't ship until they've got it, and then they end up compromising anyway. I'm thinking of stuff like
WinFS.
WinFS,
exactly. WinFS is the exact one I'm thinking.
I mean, that's what immediately came to my mind.
Yeah.
Speaking of great file systems, man, that thing was going to be amazing.
Yeah, I was excited about it.
Oh, we all were.
Spotlight kind of was like, close enough.
Well, so I do want to get to your question, but I think that dichotomy there between, or that comparison there between WinFS and Spotlight distinctly and directly highlights the difference between Microsoft and Apple very effectively. WinFS is going to be the brilliant future file system that's perfectly architected and immaculately designed and addresses all the needs scaling down from the simple PC market up to multiple distributed file systems running on thousands of servers in the cloud, handles everything in between. You can share information seamlessly between computers, searching, indexing, recovery, compression, file streams, like everything is in this this file system. And it's going to be God's gift to file systems. Like, we don't need anything else. Like, that's it. We're done. Go home.
Yeah, exactly.
And then there's Spotlight, which was derided. And, you know, you can say rightfully so. I disagree on that point, but it was derided back in the day as being a hack. And again, I disagree that it's a hack, but compared to WinFS and the glorious design that WinFS was supposed to have and the glorious implementation, it was a hack. But the difference is, it's something that shipped. It's an immediately valuable system that works within the framework of everyone's computer right now, indexing things that are immediately indexable, not making up new file types, not trying to have programs adopt to new ways of storing information, just taking files, things that are almost always, not 100% of the time, there are glaring exceptions to this, but almost always the atomic things that applications work with. And indexing those in a very pragmatic and practical way.
Yeah.
And of course, we're all familiar with like the deficiencies and the downsides of this, where Spotlight indexing is dead. Time to let my computer churn away at that. And 3 hours later, I'll come back and maybe I can search for mail messages, which is, I shouldn't harp on that. That is a bug that they fixed. But it's a pragmatic solution that gets you 80, 90, 95% of the way to the ideal solution in a way that is immediately actionable. And honestly, I'd say that's probably a distinct comparison between Apple of old and current Apple, where Apple of old would have like a whole, the Newton file system was just a set of blobs on the firmware, the flash storage, that is honestly kind of WinFS based in a way, where there was tagging and grouping and searching and indexing of these blobs that Newton applications just wrote to.
Yeah.
Well, great. That's an awesome file system design for the particular use case that you designed it for, but it's entirely different from what people are used to working with. So developers have to wrap their heads around this new way of storing information. Why do that? The Apple of today is like, oh, well, okay, this is a simple way to approach this problem and mostly addresses it. And most importantly, we can iterate and refine it in the future.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't the stake in the ground of, okay, that's it. Move on. Instead, this is a submission for, here's the first draft, and it's fantastic. You're going to be captivated by it, but we can absolutely go through and either produce sequels or iterate on this draft and refine it in the future. But right now, this is something you will very much enjoy and appreciate.
It's amazing how some people bemoan that HFS Plus still exists, but when you look at everything Apple's managed to do with it, including Spotlight and Time Machine, it's pretty amazing.
I mean, I'll be the first one to rip on HFS. I mean, It's not great. It's incredible how the longevity of that file system.
Right.
And it's also incredible and a testament to the people working on it and computers as a whole, that we don't have more file loss and more corruption, because it's not one of these quote self-preparing optimized file systems that can detect corruption and restore from backup binary trees and things like that. No, it's just storing stuff in a hierarchical manner on the disk, which compared to the ideal, you would expect to be horrible. Like, oh God, you're going to have corruption all the time. No, pragmatically in real life, no, you're just not. And it's that pragmatism that allowed them to take HFS and just plop it onto the iPhone. And even the newer iPod, or I guess old iPods used to use it, and the new ones are all fat so that they can just be mounted on Windows. But I mean, I think the simple...
Is that still the case? Can you still mount an iPod as a disc?
The iPod Classic.
So.
Huh. Cool.
Yeah, I think anything not running HFS, or sorry, not running iOS is directly mountable. They're just USB devices, as far as I'm.
I don't know why. I just haven't looked at one in ages.
So. Macworld had an article up where you could use it as a boot drive still.
Oh my God! Don't ever do that. Do not. Speaking of features that never shipped, it was rumored that was a feature, and this is actually before my time. It was rumored that was a feature back in. That was being investigated back in Panther. I started at the end of Panther, beginning of Tiger at Apple.
That you can take off your iPod?
I'm sorry? Oh, yeah. Huh. In fact, I think it shipped in one of the Panther betas. This is all, quote, public information. It's on rumor sites. Don't do it. It was cut for a reason. For the same reason, just don't do it. But getting back to HFS, it works on hundreds of millions of devices, period. Like, that's all that you need to take away from that. It's everywhere these days, absolutely everywhere. And it would be nice to have some great new file system, but it's just not, the payoff is not necessarily there in terms of engineering resources and honestly, the customer impact. I mean, if Apple's to introduce a new file system, look at it from the customer perspective. I mean, yes, there are demonstrably benefits from this, but the transition of getting people from HFS to the new file system is extremely rocky.
And well, at the very least, when you install the operating system, it's going to need to convert the disk.
Oh, yeah. And
which is just asking for trouble, right? You know?
Oh, you're not asking for trouble. You're begging for trouble. You're walking up to
trouble and punching it in the face.
Yeah. You're bringing it on. Don't do that. And that's just the conversion part. That's just getting one customer system from the old to the new and doing so in a reliable, reproducible, consistent manner that works the first time, every time on every machine.
Which arguably could be optional, and like new Macs come with a new.
Oh God. But if it's optional, that's a whole different host of issues. Yeah. I mean, communication across disks that are mounted. So you have an external drive on a new machine that has this new file system. When you format that disk, when you plug that disk in, does it get converted? Yes, no. When you format that disk, does it get the new or the old? And then if you take that disk over to some other machine, like your old laptop, are you screwed or not? Like, how do you get at the data on this new file system? How do you tell the customer that they need to upgrade their operating system? I mean,
Even FAT32 and NTFS was a pain in the ass.
Oh God. And that was one of the better, transition systems, because NTFS could actually wrap a FAT32 file system. So the act of
NTFS is awesome. System,
oh God, such a good system. The act of upgrading that file system was really just like slamming down a couple of block headers in certain places, flipping a bit, and you're good to go. And there might even have been a way to preserve it such that, and I might be making this up, but that there was still a way to read it from a FAT based system. But it was a very well designed transition.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I know HFS had that too, right? Like if you mounted an HFS plus drive on an older machine, there'd be a fake, like it would read it and there would be one file explaining where your files
were. That might be the case. I honestly don't remember the transition from HFS to HFS plus. That very well could be the case.
They had some cute hack where it, on an older device, it would look like there was something there.
Well, this little photo of a guy waving at you, like, you wish your files were here.
I feel like Syracuse must have explained it on one of his shows eventually.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sure
he has.
John's probably writing me an angry email right now.
I guess to get back, like, that for me is the difference between Apple and Microsoft on a very concrete level is WinFS and Spotlight. And then to roll that back even further, I wish I had some very concrete information. There are some things that Microsoft has published about their release process, which just baffled me. I mean, it was, I guess, again, an example of an over-engineered release process. And it's been a while since I've read the paper. I think it was a blog post that was released on Engineering Windows 7, the blog that they had back a couple of years ago. And if I recall correctly, this blog post detailed the steps that happen between when an engineer commits code to their team's repository until a Windows build with that code lands on their desk. And they have a system, and I'm totally winging it here at this point, but I think this is correct. They have a system where the engineer commits code to his team's repository, and that team then produces their own like integration route that can be applied to the current build of Windows that team is running. Once that route passes all of that team's tests and meets the requirements for like a particular release criteria, you know, like it implements a feature or something like that. Mm-hmm. They then roll that up and submit it to an organizational repository. And that organizational repository does the same thing where they aggregate all that organization's changes up and distill them out into a build that can then be tested and verified to work. And at the point where all the tests pass and all the feature requirements are in, they then roll that submission up into the central repository where they make an official, a quote, official Windows build that then again rolls back down and is used for testing and feature verification. And only after that passes do they begin doing what they call a reverse integration process, where the organization then takes that Windows build, applies it to their changes, and starts testing to verify that all of the other organizations in the company's changes have not caused any problems for them. Hmm. When that passes, it then goes down to the team and they do the exact same thing. So they've got this upwards integration process and a reverse integration process. And it was something like the span of, it was either weeks or maybe even a couple of months in some cases from when an engineer's commit to their local team repository actually ends up in an official Windows build that they themselves can install and live on and, you know, treat as like, okay, finally, my feature has officially landed.
Wow.
It's ludicrous. Like, it's absolutely ludicrous. And I say that because, and this probably goes back to my earlier comment of when you're dealing with large projects like this, you just have to be pragmatic. You have to do whatever is necessary to get shit working. And that's flying in the face of my feeling there. Microsoft, at least, is flying in the face of my feeling there by very strictly controlling and monitoring each and everything that's happening every step of the way and trying desperately, vehemently hard to prevent a regression from happening, a bug from being introduced, a feature from not working. And it may work, but at the cost of significant time and energy.
Mm-hmm. And it's very much like the WinFS thing. It's like
it is.
Design. It's overly designed. The process is overly designed rather than just trying to get something done.
That's exactly it. And I have heard, and again, this is through their blog posts, that like Sanofsky, before he left, had done a lot to kind of rip away some of this infrastructure and make it a much more lean release process. So all this could be completely and entirely outdated information. But I remember reading this back when, and this was soon after I started at Apple, reading this and thinking like, holy shit, how did they get anything done? Like, this is so clinical and controlled. And there's just no way, there's no jazz to it. There's no fluidity. There's no room for improvisation or making
things happen. No chaos theory.
It, exactly. You bang these things together, something's got to happen. And again, I can't go into Apple's specific release process, but it's much less, much less rigorous than that. Mm-hmm. And the goal always was to make the time between an engineer submitting changes and the time between an engineer submitting changes and a build being released with those changes as small as possible, as absolutely small as possible. And I can already hear engineers laughing at me because of this, because we were the team, like as a part of the program office, we were the team who did nothing at some points in time, but sit there and say, nope, not taking those changes. Nope, you're waiting. Yeah. Nope, hold that off. Nope, not taking it till next week. No, you're waiting until after the keynote, doing things like that. So there are times when you have to very carefully monitor what's going on, but for the most part, just get it in there. Be as effective at making things happen as possible. Don't strictly control. I guess this really gets to like my ethos of project management, which is kind of going back that I like the fluidity. I like the improvisation. I like the jazz of being able to do, to create these things. Like it's not a process that needs to be strictly followed. Instead, it's a framework that guides and instructs the decisions that you need to make and helps shape your opinions and helps shape your thoughts. But for what you're doing at that moment in time, you got to do what's best for whatever you're working on. You've got to listen to the people around you. You've got to let them do what they need to do. And at the same time, you know, do what you need to do. And together you can make something that sounds and is fantastic, but it's all an aspect of listening and communicating and just coordinating dynamically in real time. And that's what I always tried to do at Apple, is let people do what they need to do and just kind of get the hell out of the way of the smart people who know what they're doing. Right. I mean, as a project manager, I'm not the person working on the product. I'm not the person who's in the end, like, yes, we are the team that signs off and says we're good to go, but that's just that's just responsibility and a signature. I'm not the person who's actually responsible for making shit happen. Right. That's the engineers. That's the designers. They're the ones working the magic. I'm just there to shape and guide it. Versus what seems like at Microsoft, and I don't want to rag on Microsoft too much, but that's a much more strict, like, I guess to use the flip metaphor from jazz, they're like the conductor guiding the concert.
Where it also strikes me where they were always more reactionary. Like they saw Netscape and decided IE had to be embedded in the system, and they saw OS 10 and decided Vista had to have gloss and sheen, and it wasn't an organic growth or a planned progress of their system, but it was reaction to what other people were doing, in their opinion, successfully or in lieu of what they were doing.
You know, it's a distinct possibility. I wish I had some, again, I wish I had some concrete information on this. I mean, Windows, I guess my counter example for that would be Metro and Windows 8 and how they took a completely different tack from really everyone else in the industry, it seemed, and came up with something that was unique and original and good. And to be fair, at some level, every company is reactionary. So I would be very curious to know. Netscape is the greatest example, I suppose, in favor of that, where that was an oh shit moment of, well, we got to do something here. Okay, shove the browser into the system. Done. But for other things like
that was weird. I mean, the way that they used it in their Explorer,
yeah,
that was just arbitrary. It's like, well, we need an excuse, so let's just make the Explorer HTML like.
Yeah, pretty much, and. God, what was it? Windows Live Desktop?
Yes. Oh, God.
Oh, that was a beast. Yeah. That was so bad.
After 2000, every Windows machine I had, I would click classic mode almost instantaneously on first boot.
Oh, yeah. God, yeah. That Live Desktop is just miserably bad. And
they don't support that anymore, do they? They must support
that. Or the objects in Vista. I think that's what they called their version of.
Yeah, they still had a concept like the Vista sidebar. I forget what they called. That had a specific, the task bar or something. I mean, that's at the bottom. The sidebar, you could pin widgets there and have live web content. They've been infatuated with that for a while. I don't really get it personally, but.
Yeah. I mean, that was around the time that, remember the push web?
Oh, yes. I mean,
which is insane. I don't understand what. Yes. I know. That's exactly what I'm thinking of. Like. Revolution, push web. It's like that just doesn't happen. And there was a company. What was the big company? Well, the big company, the company that Wired covered. They did it.
It was the Java company. They got acquired by Microsoft, actually.
Oh, did they? Okay.
Didn't they? It was
probably
Marimba. Was it Marimba?
Oh yeah, that was it. That was it.
Yeah, I want to say some aspect of Marimba or like a derivative company thereof got acquired by Microsoft.
I'd believe it because I remember like. The active desktop sort of fitting into that weird hype.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It was so bad.
So weird.
I mean, frankly, from my perspective, that's another example of dictating things needing to happen versus allowing things to happen organically. I mean, everyone was on this push band. I shouldn't say everyone. A lot of people. Yeah. Push had the attention back in the late 90s, early 2000s. As being the next wave, this is what the future of the web, the internet is going to be.
Web 1.1.
Yeah. Oh God. And in reality, what happened was we got things like RSS and more advanced poll notification systems and all these things that came about organically. There was no, like somebody did something over here and somebody else did something over there. And some third person like noticed these two things and paired them together and, that got this first person to do something else. And
did those push things ever actually push, or were they just polling? I always thought it was just polling.
So I want to say that the Windows Live Desktop was all polling, but the Marimba-based system was architected specifically push. For push. Yeah, it's effectively one of the first or earliest or earlier implementations of what we have now on iOS and Android, I believe, and OS X.
Okay, interesting.
Where it was actually a legitimate push-based system.
Okay, interesting.
But you're reaching back to like 1998 me, so.
No, I mean, nobody expects anything to make sense on this show, so don't worry about it.
That's good.
There's no guarantees of correctness here. Don't.
Good. Can we just put that in a big, like, have a disclosure right at the start of this podcast?
There's no label on our tin.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah, so that was like the release process. Kind of what we were responsible for at Apple was doing whatever it took to get the release out the door, and every single bit of day-to-day work was nothing but making that happen. And it was a blast. I love that job. So much fun.
Obviously, you're not there anymore, but what do you think about this trend, both from Apple and Microsoft, to switch to yearly releases for, you know, computing operating systems?
You know, I'm intrigued by it. I think it's potentially a good step forward. If I could hedge that statement anymore, I would. So I'm a person who is always, I love embracing the future. I love looking forward and checking out new things and playing with those new things. And that's probably one of the reasons why I love my job at Apple, is I was always living on the most broken daily build possible. Like I'd take roots and source code commits from teams and build them myself and apply them, and just always moving forward on that. And likewise, I'm always installing the latest. I moved to Mavericks and iOS 7 the day they were released. Like, no question, never looking back, installed it on all my machines everywhere. All my iOS devices are on iOS 7. It's just the way I think.
Yeah, you know what? I hear that from a lot of Apple guys who were like, well, I've been, you know, when I was at Apple, I was running releases like that were way rougher than anything we'd give to the public. Yeah. So screw it, you know.
Post-Apple install disorder.
Oh my God, that should be a thing. Can we get that in the DSM-5 or whenever that comes out?
It's under not otherwise specified, but we'll try to get its own category.
So I guess in that spirit, I love the idea of yearly releases because it helps get things out there more quickly.
Mm-hmm. And it plays to this organic thing that you're talking about.
It does. It very much does. If, and this is the huge conditional, if it has the appropriate support and the appropriate infrastructure in both companies, on the engineering side, on the product release side, and perhaps most importantly, on the management side. Mm-hmm. Thinking about things in a yearly release is very different from the hit-based system we had before, where every 2, 3, 4 years, depending on 10 years, I guess, in Microsoft's case sometimes, you'd come out with this huge, fantastic release, and everyone surrounds around it. Marketing has everything ready to go, and there's keynotes, and there's commercials, and hundreds of millions of dollars to spend advertising it. And moving away from that and going towards a model where you're always constantly talking about what's new, but there's no huge infrastructure around this is the magical new release. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's more like, I guess, the Apple ads that they have right now for FaceTime and music. And I think it's just FaceTime and music. Oh, the camera. Yes, that's it. Where they demonstrate what's new and great about the product, but not in a way that says, this is iOS 6. This is iPhone 5. This is why you want these things. No, instead, this is the iPhone. This is what you're able to do right now with the iPhone. This is why you want the iPhone. This is how you could use the iPhone today in your life. And
doesn't that get more like a car commercial rather than a...
Or an old Kodak, the nostalgia timeless sort of commercials.
Yeah, maybe. You know what I mean? Any car gets you from A to B. And at a certain point, maybe releasing an operating system every year is like just making iterations
Given that explanation, I do tend to agree with the way you characterize that. It's much, much more like that than what we had in the past. I mean, you're not going to be able to have and I guess we no longer do have, but you're not going to have the emblazoned cat CDs in store boxes and on posters and on the backs of magazine covers. Instead, it's going to be, this is OS X. This is what you're using. This is how you use it. And as things get added to the system, as things evolve, as things change on a yearly or even more frequent basis, that marketing and that advertising just by its nature will change as well. Mm-hmm. So the marketing side has to change. The executive side has to change because, again, it's very easy and very powerful to group concepts together into a very big coherent release. I mean, you have tentpole themes like back to my Mac or back to the Mac and whatever Snow Leopard was, the performance, and Leopard was mail and Time Machine and slightly new UI, and Tiger was Spotlight. And, you know, you had these mm-hmm. key things that helped define and shape the release. And all the marketing, or sorry, and all the executive thinking around that would be in how these things coherently fit together in a big monolithic way. And that's very convenient, but to speed that up, to move to a yearly release model, you have to start thinking more in the organic. Okay, if we add this one thing in this release, what does that affect for the overall ethos of the operating system we're presenting to customers? And, right. and how does this fit in with our forward-looking plans? One release, two release, five releases down in the future.
Right.
Because
go ahead.
I was going to say before, you could just say like, okay, this is all going in Tiger, period. Right. We have 3 years to consider what's going to be going in Tiger, something like that. I think it took about 3 years to release that. And you can coherently think about all those things in one isolated release versus saying, okay, this is going to be coming out this year, this is going to be coming out next year, and we'll pull all of those together in the year after that with this final change that enables certain features or changes the UI or, you know, does whatever it needs to do. Mm-hmm. But having to lay that groundwork in a much more organic way is honestly a lot more difficult to think about. There's more moving pieces that need to be considered, and customer impact is always an ongoing concern instead of this one, like, okay, this is the one release these 2 years, 2-3 years that we have to really think about how customers are going to be impacted by it.
Yeah. A year is not a long time.
Oh God, no, it's no time at all. It's like, very, very little time.
You know, it's not a year really, because the last 3 months, you're just trying to wrap everything up. So they don't count.
At the very least.
Like a year means you've spent maybe 6 months developing.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. At best. Yeah. And to be fair, things have happened in the recent past that have given a lot more flexibility to this model. Like the app stores are a great example where it's no longer do we have to have we're not contracting out to CD pressers or DVD pressers all over the world to get sufficient media to saturate Best Buys and Apple stores and CompUSA or whatever replaced CompUSA Best Buys.
I remember having this conversation. It was one of the first conversations we had, actually, where you were describing how much of a pain in the ass and what the lag time is trying to get all the CDs pressed.
Yeah.
And also Microsoft did something goofy with that, too.
Did they?
You were explaining. I don't know. You were explaining. It was years ago. That I can't remember.
Yeah.
But it was like, holographic.
Well, it's because they have like 20 different versions of stuff.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Like you guys ship like a unilingual OS. And I went out and I actually tried to buy Windows 7, and I couldn't because the only versions I could find were Francophone, which is fine. It's Quebec. It's understandable. But I'd like an English version because I have an English keyboard.
What I disliked is when you had a product key, but you couldn't find a CD from the same era as your product key.
Oh, yeah.
The
release infrastructure around Microsoft is daunting. Like and frankly, the iOS side of things, and I don't believe I'm revealing anything by saying this, it's in a similar boat because they have different requirements that need to be met by all the different carriers. And well, hell, you when you download an image, we all know that you're faced with that list of like, oh well, shit, which I have flip my iPhone model over and find the little serial or the model identifier in the back, and it's
iphone.com/LTE
that confuses me, and I kind of know what I'm talking about. I'm like, oh, I still don't know which one to get.
One thing I thought was also interesting, though, is that Microsoft, after a while, they split a lot of their stuff into Windows Live and made it downloadable. Like the Mail app was separate, and a bunch of other, I think the Movie Maker app became separate downloads. And that idea of decoupling apps, I know like iTunes gets updated outside of OS X, and I think Safari sometimes, QuickTime used to be, but the idea of pulling a lot of the apps out of the operating system and maybe putting them in an app store or putting them on a web download, I thought was an interesting play, at least from Microsoft's side.
I think it's fascinating. I mean, I would love for the system apps to become much, much more decoupled from the system itself. Yeah. I guess maybe this will be my theme for the podcast. I like the idea of the improvisation and that can happen when teams are allowed to work in an isolated manner and there is cohesion across planning in the company, but there's not cohesion necessarily in the release of those products out to the customer. Mm-hmm. So the teams are allowed to innovate more quickly, fix bugs more quickly. But especially for a company like Apple, that's an incredibly difficult proposition to make. Well, even for Microsoft, I was surprised when they released the live Windows Live stuff. And just the challenges that are involved with that, again, with customer support, like shit, which version of Mail do you have? Okay, you've got this. Oh, you haven't applied that upgrade. Oh, but you're on this version of Windows. Okay, that means you got to do X, Y, and Z. versus having it all tied into the operating system where it's like, okay, you're on Mountain Lion. Sweet. We know what version of mail you got. We can totally help you out with that. And you know, that goes back. How can we make these things more organic? It's the yearly release is powerful. Decoupling applications are powerful. But that introduces enormous amounts of complexity elsewhere that need to be very, very carefully considered before
you any almost,
decisions can be made.
Yeah, that's how you land in DLL hell.
It is. That's exactly it.
To steal a Windows-ism, you know? Like, or, you know, even the Linux stuff where there's just mismatched versions of, like, frameworks and...
Or like Chrome OS where everything just updates and no one even knows what version they're on of anything anymore.
Well, that's actually...
Well, that's different, I'd posit
that is the platonic ideal, at least that we can envision today, of an always up-to-date operating system. And I say that because there is such a strict, at least right now, there is such a strict separation between Chrome OS and the Chrome apps that there is very little that can go wrong in that process. Mm-hmm. And because both the apps and the operating system are both independently and always up-to-date, I don't believe there's any way to disable them, at least on the Chrome OS side of things. Like Chrome, you can turn that off and whatever. But on the Chrome OS side, I'm pretty sure, and I've never looked into this, I could be totally wrong, but I'm pretty sure there's no easy way to disable it from auto-updating either the operating system or the apps that you have installed from the Chrome store. And that's perfection. I mean, that's great because that means you eliminate a lot of the complexity, you eliminate a lot of that DLL hell. You eliminate a lot of the questions of like, oh, well, you've got this version of Chrome OS and you're running this. Oh, you're two releases behind on this application. Okay, that means you got to do this and really complexifying the support model. Instead, they're just like, oh, you got Chrome. Sweet. We know exactly what you're on. We know exactly how to move you forward. We're good to go.
Yeah. As an OS nerd, you can't look at Chrome and not kind of be like, well, yes, this is the way to do it. Yeah. Like there's such a separation of purpose and responsibilities.
Yep.
As an experienced nerd, you're like, no, this is just bullshit. You know, like,
well, I don't know about you guys.
I mean, like, there's a bit of a dichotomy going on there.
As soon as Apple announced auto updates for apps, we kept getting all these messages from people going, "I'm never going to do that because I'm petrified that I'll get a bad update and I won't be able to control it." And that you start dealing with fear of and change adversity at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm one of those guys that didn't update Twitter for ages because of the dick bar.
Ah, dick bar.
You know, but on the other hand, as soon as I got Mavericks installed, I just turned on auto updates. I think it's a good idea in general.
As far as I'm concerned, I love it. Like, I absolutely am infatuated with the idea. But again, I'm one of those people who is always aggressively living on the most recent thing. Mm-hmm. I installed Twitter when it gave me the dick bar, and I then promptly moved over to Tweetbot. lived on that. I find myself very frustrated with people who have a very strong, firm grip on the past and not wanting to change. And it's something, honestly, to me, I find a little soul crushing. Like, why can you not be excited about the future? Why do you have to view these things with fear and trepidation and paranoia? Why can't you just explore, discover, and adapt to what's new and figure out, okay, things have changed. This sucks, but maybe there's some things that are better. Maybe there's different ways that I could do the things that I wanted to do. And there's obviously
the same way. Yeah.
There are very clear exceptions to that. Like, hey, guess what? iOS or what was it? Xcode 4 something. I forget which model broke or which version broke simulator deployments. You adopt the latest one and suddenly, boom, dead in the water. Well, shit. I am now completely unable to do my job. Thanks a whole lot. And so there are counterexamples. Or like, I'm working on a Hollywood motion picture. Like, of course I'm not going to update Final Cut Pro or whatever editing studio you're using while you're producing this film.
Yeah.
You're going to hold that off until after all the shit's done.
I found that a fascinating sort of thunderstorm in a teacup. Okay, so this isn't Vue, but that's fine. You've still got, like, nothing's changed. Like, you don't have to go buy this.
And
it's getting there. I mean, it's added all the stuff that people bitched about. So
I find it amazing just how offended. And I want to say this delicately because, again, I do understand many other points of view. But one thing I don't understand is the outright fury that somebody can have when a new version that they don't have to update to. It's not like a requisite update. It's not something being forced upon them. Mm-hmm. Makes a change that they don't like.
Yeah.
Just don't upgrade. Well, I mean, yeah. It's just don't upgrade. Yeah. And if it stops meeting your needs, then you do have the right. You do have, I totally understand your complaint there. Like, okay, so you're on like a decrepit Mac Pro, because they're all decrepit these days. You're on a decrepit Mac Pro running an
even
old new, version.
Even right out of the box, they're actually decrepit.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It falls to waste in your hands. Like CPUs drop out. And so you've got like an old Mac Pro and you're running a version of Final Cut that you've had for ages, Final Cut 7 or whatever it was. And this new Mac Pro comes out. And let's say hypothetically, because I don't think this is the case, but let's say hypothetically, your old version of Final Cut doesn't work on the new Mac Pro. Well, you obviously want to upgrade to the newest Mac Pro, especially if you're doing Final Cut work, because it's going to be phenomenally faster. Maybe not on 7, because that's more CPU bound, but it's going to be a much faster machine. And as a result, you're then forced to upgrade to Final Cut Pro 10. I can then kind of understand your frustration, your anger, because that's a bad situation to be in. But if somebody just releases a new version that you don't like, so what? I mean, so what?
If your car used leaded gas.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, a lot of the anger around the rumored gold iPhone. Again,
I don't understand the anger about that.
Neither do I. First of all, it's not also, like this is something new. And second of all, it doesn't affect you.
Just don't buy it.
It just doesn't affect you. Yeah. It truly baffles me. Absolutely baffles me. But that people are entitled to their opinion. So
yeah. So the flip side of that is, man, this is going to be a long talk because I still want to talk to you about your actual company.
You got time.
Apple.
Yeah. The flip side of that is something like Xcode, where Apple basically drags you along the upgrade path.
Oh, yes, they do.
And it, you know, occasionally breaks your workflow, or, you know, in the case of Xcode 4, basically makes you work in a single window. Which really kind of pissed me off, but you know, I adapted. How do you feel about bitching about that? I mean, I complain. I don't get angry and hate people. I actually talked to the guy that killed IB. The engineer who took IB and stuck it inside Xcode was like, "Yeah, we kind of think it's a good idea. Sorry." And I was like, I don't know. It's in some ways it works because you can integrate better.
Ugh,
but but to me, sticking everything inside Xcode or iTunes is a sign that communicating between individual apps isn't sufficiently supported by the operating system.
God, honestly, in IB's case, I'm not even sure. Actually, in IB's case, yeah, that is true. Because some of the things that they did introduce with Xcode 4.
Yeah, like dragging from a property into, you know.
Yeah, that's totally true.
You couldn't do that between apps. So,
yeah. And no, I think, so Xcode 4 is honestly probably the best concrete counterexample you'd ever offer me to the always living on the future idea that I hold.
4, 5 is actually pretty good. 5 feels like Snow Leopard for...
So 5 Leopard is utterly fantastic compared to 4. Honestly, the real truth is I barely used 3. I used Project Builder some back in college. I barely used Xcode 3, 1 or 2. Very rarely did I use Xcode because I was in project management back when those were coming out. So I lost all my coding skills atrophied. but Xcode 4 and 5. Xcode 4, was the first Xcode I started using when I began my current company. We can use Segway to the future.
Awesome.
So when I started at Tumult, founded Tumult, I adopted Xcode 4. Jonathan was on Xcode 3. And I didn't understand a lot of the pain because to me it was just Xcode. This is for me is a whole new world that I'm being reintroduced to that I haven't really been a part of for the past 6 years. So it worked out fine for me until I became much more comfortable with the development process. And then, I mean, why can't they just add fucking windows to Xcode? Tabs are not windows. They're just not.
Like often I want a header. I want a system header on one side of my giant screen and I want my code on the other. Yeah. So that I can refer to what I'm about to call.
And the split screen management and the tab management systems just don't work for that. They don't work as well as Windows did.
I know, which is like, mind-boggling. Actually, Windows got a lot worse. Visual Studio, honestly, around 2000, Microsoft was killing it. Visual Studio was great. Windows 2000 was great. And then feature creeps in, and they just – like, you used to be able to, like, run a thing, and the console would automatically pop up. Like, the window management with – Visual Studio was always a single window environment, but it worked really well for a little bit, and then they just got fancy. Like, you'd hit escape and shit with animate, and it's just like, animate. Just get – just – yeah. Hated it. It tried to be smart when it really shouldn't have been. And I feel like Xcode kind of went down that path.
I think you're probably correct on that. That's a very fair analysis to make.
Yeah. But they are pulling back.
So again, Xcode 5 is a fantastic move forward. I really am happy with the evolution that's happened between 4 and 5. Legitimate, very concrete.
Yes.
Very good advancements have happened. But I still wish I could close tabs without closing the main window and not have a tab window open. Like, tabs just piss me off.
Yes. Tabs are a bad idea. I don't know why people got excited that they were in the Finder.
I hate them in the Finder. They don't make any sense in the Finder. They're just... No. The only place where tabs make sense are the browser, and that's...
You know what? You know why? It's because having that many windows open feels stupid.
Exactly.
But... So wait, let me see right now. 1, 2, 3, 4. I've got about 10 windows open. Each of them probably have at least 5 tabs in them. I have no idea what is going on.
Yeah.
It's just stuff I want to read. And it's... I can't find it. I don't know. Like, weeks later, I'll come back. I'll be like, oh, yeah.
Oh, hey, that interesting article that is now totally out of date.
Or they'll refresh and audio will start playing. You can never find the window with audio in. Yeah. Or you'll close a browser and you'll kill a tab that had unsaved work in. I mean, it's a nightmare.
I know. When audio starts playing, it's crazy.
I was going to say, guy, just telling me that, you're making me cringe. Like,
I know. I can't manage all of this idiocy.
You're evil. Like, that's just evil.
So...
But
I've seen like Rogue Amoeba. Sorry, just a sec. I've seen Rogue Amoeba literally get requests to figure out which one of the tabs is playing audio so that people can find it and close it. And it's impossible to do because the process is playing it rather than the tab. So you can't. Maybe you can figure it out now. But that's very now. That's like a 10.9 thing that maybe it'll work. Is. Yeah, maybe that could work now. So honestly, that's probably the next killer app. Is stop
tab killer.
Shut, I mean, really, shut you're the just better off. Safari. Yeah, you're just better off silencing the entire process. Just
just kill it. Yeah.
Death to sound.
Sorry. So tabs. Yeah.
Well, so the problem that I have, and I guess I'm not going to harp on tabs too much. They're annoying, but Xcode 5 is a great step forward. Yeah. The problem is, and this getting back to your point about being dragged forward with Xcode. So our app Hype still runs on 10.6. Like, we still support 10.6, even with the new version that just came out.
That was a key thing I wanted to ask you about. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was very conscious. Of course, it was a conscious decision. Yeah. We just like trip and say, oh, hey, 10.6 support. But it's becoming increasingly painful to support 10.6. And we don't necessarily want to drop it for customer reasons. Like, we want to support our customers who are still running these old versions of the operating system. And up until this most recent release, we didn't have any analytics to say who was running what and to be able to make intelligent decisions about cutting support for operating systems. Mm-hmm. So as a result, we're still supporting 10.6. And on Xcode 4.3, 4.2 or 4.3, one of the two, they actually dropped support for the 10.6 SDK. They just ripped it out. And there was no way in the way that they did it. And I'm not sure in the details of it. I've tried to work around it a couple different ways. But you can't just add it back to the xcode.app/content/developer/whatever it is to get the SDK back there. It's impossible to add it back in, at least not in a way that I found. And that means that our build system, we have a little build bot that just runs on a Mac Mini. It has to run 10.7, and it has to run a specific version, like the most recent version of Xcode that hasn't yet dropped support for the 10.6 SDK, so that we're always building in the background to make sure that when we're doing our builds on our local machines, which so we can run modern versions of the operating system, we're just building against latest OS 10 SDK, that we're not ever adopting APIs not supported in the 10.6 SDK, because there's no good infrastructure in Xcode to warn you about that. So we just continue to build always in the background on 10.6 or with the 10.6 SDK on 10.7. And with Xcode 5, they drop support for the 10.7 SDK. So even if we decide to drop 10.6, we're still screwed on Mavericks and Xcode 5 because we can't support the 10.7 SDK. So are we going to drop 10.7? That's an even harder call to make.
Yeah.
So being dragged forward with Xcode like this does become very frustrating. But at the same time, I'm still living on the most recent version. Like, I'm always pushing hard and trying to find ways to live on that most recent version.
Yeah. Business realities dictate that you have to worry about this stuff.
Yeah.
A friend of mine who was on iOS team, who's a manager on iOS for a while, left and is now doing mobile development for a popular startup. I'm trying to be vague, but still convey. Yeah, right.
I think I know exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm trying to give enough vague sketch so that you can figure it out. But I don't want to.
Totally
can't talk out of turn. And I was having dinner with him, and I was talking about iOS 7, and he was like, "Well, we can't drop iOS 6 because so many of our customers still have 3GSs," and I'm like, welcome to the real world, buddy. Is that a shock for you guys? That, like,
oh yeah,
you know.
Because
you do work. I mean, at Apple, you work on the latest greatest, and that's more or less all you care about, right? When you get out into the rest of the world, you suddenly start realizing that it's like, I've got customers that.
Oh God, yeah, it's a fucking cold, harsh reality out here, man. I miss the warm embrace of Apple. No, for me in particular, and perhaps me especially, given I came straight from, like, my job before I was at Apple, I interned at a defense contractor before Apple. Like, it's, and in college, my yearly job at school was a systems administrator, dealing with all the Unix systems on campus. And I never had to deal with, like, yeah, systems administrator, I'm supporting and helping build applications for these people who need stuff to happen, but it's not supporting customers. And working for a defense contractor, I mean, that's a whole separate world there. Like, that's a crazy isolated world. So I jumped from those straight to Apple, having never developed customer facing software and felt that reality. And I moved straight into a role that, for better or for worse, helped me or allowed me to help shape the future of OS X in a very concrete, very direct manner. I could shape the future of OS X. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that my lack of experience has honestly ever led me to make decisions that seriously negatively affected developers or customers in a way that I would do differently given the chance again with my experience now. But I didn't have the very visceral concrete experience I have now of dealing with the real world and the diverse set of customer systems that are out there. And the fact that I'm not deploying an operating system that's always going to be, by its nature, is always going to introduce the new world to people. Mm-hmm. Instead, I'm developing an application that lives in the diverse set of worlds that have been released over the past 7-6 years.
Yeah.
Like, it's a very different experience. One is focused on always producing the new, and the other, and of course, supporting the old. Like, I don't want to ever make people think that Apple just says ship it and forget it. They very much do support the old, but my role at the company was always producing the new. Like, it was always forward-looking, forward-focused. And now I'm producing the new, but in a way that has to run across all of the operating systems that Apple has produced within a given span of time.
Yeah.
And that is, let me tell you, I would love to drop 10.7 support, because that is, to be just perfectly, honestly blunt, an absolute clusterfuck of a release when it comes to sandboxing. A complete clusterfuck. It's so bad. It's miserably bad. Like, we can't run on 10, or we have issues running on 10.7.0 to 10.7.3 because they didn't introduce certain APIs necessary to access file resources.
That's the worst. That's
That's not the worst.
Well,
there's a bug in 10.7.4 that, due to our sandboxing provisioning profile, Hype will not launch. It just won't launch. It's a known bug in 10.7.4. Or maybe it was 10.7.3 something. Yeah, it's a special little provision addition that we have that just causes Hype to not launch. And then the crowning achievement, there is one build of 10.7.5 in which Hype will again not launch ever. It fails in DYLD bring up. It just doesn't get anywhere. That is silently fixed in a second roll of 10.7.5. So there's 10.7.5, 11G63. If you're on 11G63, that build works. If you're on like 11G59 or something like that, it doesn't. And so we can't just say, oh, are you running the latest version of Lion? Or sorry, yeah, Lion.
Yeah.
Instead, we, or no, Mountain Lion.
Mountain Lion. Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever. We can't just say, are you running the most recent version of 10.7? Instead, we have to be like, are you going to system preferences, click on the little, the build number there and read us the string of digits that comes out. Like, oh, yeah. Go and download the special patch from Apple. It's a friggin' nightmare. It's so bad. Because in all these cases, it's either silent failures that we can't message the user.
Yeah.
Or things just don't work. I mean.
Yeah, when the OS decides to kill like a sandbox thing when you boot up.
You're done.
They don't say anything. There's you cannot do anything.
Yep.
Which I guess makes sense.
Yeah, from a security perspective, certainly.
Yeah. But from a user, oh God, it's horrible.
It is. Horrible. And those are the kinds of things that before.
You know what they should do? They should have some kind of resource that you can stick in your app bundle that when they kill you for a security thing, they can pop up and just be like,
blame Apple?
No. Well, I mean, whatever. Whatever text you want to put in, it basically allows the user to get in touch with you. It would be nice.
It would be very nice, yes. You should follow Radar.
Oh, God. Is that even up these days?
Ouch. Oh.
I'm just being
a dick. While they're down. That's.
I know.
It's a very different perspective that I never had at Apple, and it's been enlightening. And if I were to go back, you know, hypothetically go back and do it again, I don't think I would change any decisions or reevaluate things that happened while I was at Apple. Yeah. But if I were to go back and do it all over again, I would have a very different point of view that I think would color a lot of my decisions very differently. So.
Yeah. It sounds like they should do like what the Amish do and force everyone to go out and run a company for a year and then come back.
You know, I've heard of worse ideas. I'd get behind that.
Yeah. To be fair, I actually support Apple just barreling forward and sort of giving the finger to. I think one of the things that trips Microsoft up is this looking backward and trying to be nice and wrong.
I absolutely agree. Very much so.
And I do think that Apple's doing it right. I just think that they don't necessarily understand how tricky the situation is for third-party developers.
I honestly do. So I agree on your first point that I like Apple barreling ahead. I really do. I love it. Keep going as fast as you can, please.
Yeah. But you disagree with me that they don't understand what it's like for a third-party developer?
Correct. People really do, even at the executive level, people understand a lot of the decisions that they make and how they will affect the customers and the developers. And of course, in Apple's list of priorities, it is
customers.
Number one, Apple. Number two, customers. Number three, developers.
Right.
And I put Apple
people,
first.
I mean, because people they need can to get that tattooed.
Customers if they put themselves first. Like,
right.
Customers are everything for Apple. That is everything. That's all they care about. And developers are a very important part. Again, I'm not trying to say this is a bad thing about Apple. They know that developers play a very crucial key role in this because unless there's a vibrant ecosystem on their platforms, the customers aren't going to come.
Yeah. My perspective has always been that as a third-party developer, our role is to make Apple's products better for Apple.
In a sense, yeah.
By serving their customers well. Do you know
animal
what I mean?
Husbandry,
I think you're right. Yeah.
Animal husbandry. Yeah. Like, I don't think that Apple's role is to provide a platform for us. I think that our role is to write software that makes Apple's products look good. From Apple's perspective. Do you know what I mean?
It certainly makes our lives easier when we do that. I mean, it goes back to Jury's talk at Mike Jurowitz, for those who aren't familiar, talk at the last Singleton. I think he nailed a lot of key points where the ballpark that we're playing in is Apple's.
Mm-hmm.
And by following their rules and by being a good participant in that game, they're happy to elevate us to a different level and to exemplify us to other customers and developers. And by not following those rules, it's it's painful. It can be really rough at times.
And I'm not saying that's philosophically great. I'm just saying that if you at least look at the situation pragmatically from that perspective, things get easier and you get a little less frustrated because your expectations are set, right?
Yeah, I think that's totally right. Yeah. And I share that same opinion. It's not necessarily correct, but it's not necessarily wrong either. And it's just the pragmatic view of what of the platform that we have chosen to develop on. That is the nature of the game.
Yeah.
So were we on Linux, it'd be different. Were we on Windows, it'd be different still. Yeah. Were we on Xbox, it'd be different a fourth time. But we chose iOS and OS X, and that's...
This is the nature of the relationship that you should expect with Apple.
Yeah. I mean, effectively, it's like being aware that if you are going to develop an Xbox game and you want to be on the Xbox marketplace, you've got to go through the Xbox certification process and pay these fees and do these things. And it's the exact same idea. And likewise, if
you're on Linux, by the way, is far more rigorous than the App Store.
Oh, God, yes. I've only heard stories, thankfully. But
I mean, certification for the consoles is a little bit over the top. Like, you need exact wording and exact dialogue boxes about, like, we are now saving, don't unplug your machine. Like, they have very specific things that you have to say.
You know, if there's one thing I want from the next generation consoles, it's for that damn dialogue to go.
Having said everything you said, Ryan, what was it that attracted you to going indie, to leaving Apple and setting up Tumult and starting your own products?
Thank you, Renee, for dragging us into what I actually wanted to talk to Ryan about after over an hour and a half of talking with him.
Yeah, hey, that's what happens.
To be continued on the next episode of Debug.